Hi! Active History is happy to present a recording of Murray Brewster's talk, After the Savage War, reporting on battles in Afghanistan and at home. It was part of the 2013 Ottawa Historical Association lecture series. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.
Ladies and gentlemen, listen, thank you very much for coming down and spending your evening with me. I hope you'll get something out of it. I've got a prepared text that here, and I'll refer to it here and there. But I've just come from covering a disaster, the Senate scandal. I literally walked out of the Red Chamber. It's all over. It's all done with. The three senators have been expelled, and history has been made. And it's an unfortunate bit of history. And I'm not trying to cast this to you in political terms of liberal or conservative, because I honestly believe that regardless of what party is in power. The wielding of that power is done in a similar manner. So it's an evening where you're going to get a bit of reflection on that, because it actually ties into this. It actually ties in to the war, because politics was a very big part of how this war was prosecuted. The politics of, thank you very much, the politics of perception, the politics of denial. So with that, what I'm about to say is probably not going to be well received in some quarters. And by the time that I'm done here, I'm sure that there are going to be some who are going to accuse your guest of being ill-tempered and over-opinionated. And this is going to especially perhaps be true in the journalism community, because I might even be labeled as a bit of a heretic, because some of what I'm going to want to talk to you about here extends beyond the confines of history, and it is going to be inclusive of the rather bruising world of the media these days, as well as politics, because those are the places where our perceptions are created, our perceptions of events. And I would suggest to you more than ever that these two distinct worlds, politics and the media, have become fused and indivisibly linked. And I believe that someone needs to speak with some candor about that, because what I saw in Afghanistan underscored for me that lives are at stake. Now, lives were at stake in what happened tonight in the Senate. You have three people whose livelihoods have been taken away from them. We can debate what they have done, but at the moment, they have not been charged with a crime. And yet, we have one of the legislative bodies of this country that has passed sentence on them in a manner that could potentially affect whatever court cases come along. And we are rapidly, as far as I'm concerned, approaching a crossroads as a nation where we could topple into a new dark age, one that where perceptions and slogans and marketing trump evidence, principle, and substance. Now, you're going to have to forgive me for standing here and not saying that all is right with the world and that our efforts in Afghanistan were a smashing success and that everybody there loves us. I know that it's something that many of our fellow countrymen want to hear, and it's something that our politicians have demanded to hear, especially from the media. And when they haven't, even the most good-natured and generous skepticism has been cause for wild-eyed charges of treason. It wasn't really that long ago that if you were questioning the treatment of prisoners, of Taliban prisoners, that somehow you were a Taliban lover. And if you were questioning how the war was being conducted, you were not supporting the troops. Now, before I launch into this full-throated critique, it should be perfectly clear that I am an employee of good standing, hopefully, with the Canadian press, And my views here tonight are my own. They don't represent my employer. And I'm here by invitation, and I alone am responsible for what I am about to say. Believing that we as a nation have a constructive role in the world and a constructive role to play is something that I have held dear throughout my nearly 30 years in journalism. And I believe that journalists have a duty, even a sacred obligation, to call it as they see it. Now, I'm here to present to you what I saw in the almost 6 years of covering Afghanistan, the war, and often the incoherent attempt at nation building. Now, I have no axe to grind. I have no grudges to settle here with individuals or institutions, just an unwavering sense that we had the best of intentions at heart, and this perspective is now going to be talking to you about how those best of intentions were bent, twisted, distorted, and even buried by what Kipling very aptly called heathen folly. And I'm concerned about this because I believe our experience in Afghanistan and in the Senate tonight are crucial to the future of our nation and our society, and a society that believes in fairness and that believes in helping others. Ladies and gentlemen, history is alive. It's a breathing thing that may come as a shock, even in this very well-read and well-reasoned crowd. The notion that history is dead, written and carved into stone, immovable, is ingrained in us pretty much early on, because most often our education system strangles the very life out of the events by the way it teaches history to us. Our first perceptions of events, though, are formed by the media and our political leaders. Ladies and gentlemen, our history is what we make it. And if history is to be ignored, you first have to record it and consider it. Now, that's a very important point, because it's part of what I want to talk to you about a little bit, about the media and how the media's perception shaped Afghanistan and is shaping events like what happened this evening. So much of what passes for news today can only be generously described as trivial, insular escapism. The reflex to entertain has regularly trumped our desire to inform. The duty to be fair and accurate has often been overtaken by the need to be edgy and controversial. The demand of impartiality has been poisoned on the taste of partisan politics. Sometimes we've choked on it, and when I say we, I mean we in the media. Other times we have willingly and even happily swallowed such bile. Now, that's not to say that organizations, all organizations, have succumbed to the siren call in this post-mass media world. And there are some who still serve as a beacon of principles and the ideals of journalism that we hold dear. But I would argue that the pressure to trivialize and even to avoid serious discussion is at the worst point I've seen it in almost 30 years in journalism. Polarization, the notion that you're either with us or you're against us, has seeped into just about every corner of our public discourse. It is what I've sometimes described as the criminalization of legitimate criticism. No longer are we able to constructively deconstruct policies and decisions without somehow being accused of harboring an agenda or being an outright dissident. As I said earlier, questions about how prisoners of war are treated, you're accused of being a Taliban sympathizer. One asks about the broad reach of the internet surveillance legislation, and you're accused of standing with child pornographers. You ask about due process in the rush to justice in the Senate, you're accused of being on the side of people who have fleeced the taxpayers. It is that kind of toxic stew in which Canada waded into that nation-building exercise in Kandahar. Now, to truly understand what we've gotten ourselves into, it's instructive to lay out a few figures that in the humble estimation of this journalist speak volumes about the nearly impossible task that we set for ourselves. Does anyone here have, this is an obscure fact, but does anyone here have an idea what the illiteracy rate in Kandahar or in Afghanistan was in 2006? A 6% literacy rate? You're a little far off, but essentially in Kandahar City in 2005, the illiteracy rate was 65%. Now think about that for a moment. Two-thirds of the population could not read or write. Now I remember military officers pointing with pride to the red purplish signs on the back of armored vehicles and jeeps that were warning the local population to stay back from convoys, lest they be shot. The signs instituted were there after a series of civilian shootings that killed a number of people, a number of residents in Kandahar. So imagine that, putting up signs, warning signs, for people who can't read. The nominal unemployment rate in Kandahar in 2006 was 43%. The figures were staggering, but the reality was even more brutal. It has become bloated cliche to talk about how Afghanistan is a land that suffered through 30 years of war. Most people don't get beyond that sort of superficial characterization. Very rarely do they ask themselves, what does that mean? Very rarely today do we stop and consider and take a moment to think about what some of the figures and statistics and information that we're given means. What can be sad and somewhat horrifying is how startled some people appear to be by the stark poverty and brutal nature of Afghan life. What was evident, but sometimes not directly apparent, was how the very fabric of society had become almost unrecognizable to Western eyes. How the constant warfare had ripped the souls of these people to shreds. The sense of community and altruism that we take for granted here. How we help each other as neighbors doesn't exist there. They are very rare commodities. Whereas we think of ourselves, our families, our towns, and our provinces, and our country as existing on a sliding scale of importance depending upon the circumstance, the Afghans have a very different consideration. They think of themselves, their families, their tribes, without fail. Rarely, very rarely, do they think of their nation as a whole. The former mayor of Kandahar was a man by the name of Ghulam Haider Hamidi. And he was a wonderful man. I met him first in 2007. And he was an expat. He had spent the bulk of his life, I would suggest, or almost half of it, in Virginia as an accountant. So he had very many Western sensibilities, very many things, qualities about him that we would all recognize. And because it's hard to convey to you how, when you end up in a society, especially in rural Kandahar, you end up in a society that in some respects is almost out of the Bronze Age. Very little mechanization, no electricity, sensibilities that we don't understand. You almost feel like you're on the far side of the moon. But for me, Mayor Hamidi became a link, a bridge, under which you could understand what was going on in Afghanistan. And he tried very hard to turn that city and that community around from 2007. And you'll have to excuse me, because he was a wonderful gentleman. And I guess the best way to actually get to the heart of this story is to tell you about the last time that I saw him. I was in Kandahar. It was the 6th of July, 2011, And I've been there to do a goodbye sort of interview with him because, you know, what has Canada contributed and how has it changed Canada Heart, et cetera. We had a wonderful interview in the Governor's Palace where his office was. And we finished the interview and walked out onto the marble sort of atrium and porch that is there at the Governor's Palace. And I'm standing there and having a conversation with him, and I look across the rather well-manicured lawns of the Governor's Palace, and I see three men coming towards us. And 15 months in Afghanistan, you get to know what the Taliban looks like. You get to know what the look in their face is like. And all I could think of when I saw these three men coming across the front lawn was, how the F did they get in here? Because the Governor's Palace was very well guarded, and we finished our conversation, but these men came directly up to the mayor and began buttonholing him. All I could think as they were walking up was, suicide bomber. That's all I could think of. And there's a part of me that just sort of braced as they got, and it happened within a matter of seconds, as they got to the front porch. But they, instead of blowing up, they blew up figuratively at the mayor. Yes, they were Taliban, but they had been part of the reintegration program. They were part of the government's effort to try and convince Taliban fighters to lay down their arms. They were coming to complain to anybody, the governor, the mayor, because the food and the lodging that they had been promised by the Afghan government had been cut off. Needless to say, I breathed a huge sigh of relief when this wasn't what I thought it was. And I even managed to, you know, cop a quick interview with these gentlemen. Why that story is significant is because 10 days later, Mayor Hamady was standing in exactly the same spot when someone came and blew him up. He was being blamed because he was trying to clean up the city. There were a number of people who were squatting on different parcels of land around the city because 3 years of war, no deeds, everything else had been destroyed. And he had been systematically going through and challenging the warlords or challenging the people who were on these lands. And for what amounts to a zoning dispute, this gentleman was killed. What made him special and what happened during that last conversation that him and I had was that, you know, I said to him, I said, you don't have to be here. Like, you have a target on your back. You've done this for almost 5 years. Isn't it time to kind of get a better assignment in Kabul, or, you know, perhaps, you know, go back to the States? And, you know, he had many ties here. He has a daughter in Toronto. And, you know, he could have gone back to live a very, very comfortable life. Yet he chose to stay. He chose to stay, and his words to me were, he said, this is the city where I was born. It's fed me. I've got my education here. These are my people. And in the last years of my life, I want to be able to give something back to those people. He was able to give something back until they killed him. That sense of altruism is a sense that we often take for granted here in this country. And you don't find it in Afghanistan. Now, there exists, despite my rather gloomy picture that I've painted here, a very generous spirit towards outsiders, often under it's been codified under Pashtun Wali, and that's the canon of the tribes of southern Afghanistan and northern Pakistan. People may seem remote and stone-faced and enigmatic on the surface, but once you are accepted, people will often die defending you. Getting accepted is the hard part, though. Reaching that layer of distrust. Now, I have come to appreciate how dark and bitter and cynical the Afghan heart can be. Many of my best friends in Kandahar have a very tart, very dark sense of humor. We would mistake it as flippancy. How much of this complex place did we understand before we went in? Not very many. Not very much. Not only was there a dearth of military intelligence, but the development and diplomatic understanding of the culture, tribal, and political complexities of Kandahar did not exist. I have to underscore that. It did not exist. To quote a good friend of mine in the military, we had no idea who was who in the zoo. Now, I'm going to share a little secret with you, too, something that didn't make it into my book. In 2005, there was supposed to be an assessment that weighed the merits of going into Kandahar against the merits of going to Herat in the western part of Afghanistan. It had only just begun. It had not even been written when the reviewing officer in Afghanistan was told that the decision to go to Kandahar had already been made. Imagine that. You're going into one of the most dangerous parts of the world, and you haven't done your homework. After the shooting started, precious little resources were expended trying to understand what was going on as well, and I document this in the book. At the provincial reconstruction base in Kandahar, which was the main showcase of Canada's development under fire, there was only one intelligence officer, a military reservist, who was devoted to trying to untangle the Gordian knot of narco-drug trafficking, political intrigue, and do-goodism. It wasn't until the Canadian surge of civilians in 2008 and finally U.S. troop surge in 2010 that you saw some real resources being devoted to developing a picture of what was understanding on the ground. The arrival of human terrain mapping teams who parsed people and villages based upon their tribal affiliations, the background of local politicians, it added so much to the sophistication of our understanding of what was going on. I can't begin to describe to you what the difference was. The grievances, which were the very underpinnings of the insurgency, had all of a sudden started to become clear when we started to understand these things. The reasons that the Afghans were picking up the weapons, aside from their desire to feed their families, became all too obvious. The ancient tribal rivalries for drug routes all of a sudden stopped being classified as Taliban attacks. Because you see, in Kandahar, a bomb will go off. It could be a narco drug lord. It could be a government warlord. It could be the Taliban. But it's always all blamed on the Taliban, no matter what. No matter who did it, it was always, oh, it's the Taliban. And we bought that. We bought that for a very long time, and we paid very dearly for our ignorance. Very early in the war, a British colonel, who was perhaps the most articulate officer I ever met, summed up our dilemma after the shooting started as being as simple as a race against the Taliban to provide more suitable employment to masses of unemployed in the region. We lost that race, ladies and gentlemen, for the better part of 5 years. Sure, Canadians provided some make-work projects and make-work programs for a few hundred souls, clearing irrigation ditches that had been blown up by the Soviets when they retreated almost two decades before. Sure, we provided a few hundred jobs on road-clearing projects in the latter half of the war, but it paled in comparison to what we could have potentially done. I remember sitting with Ahmad Wali Karzai, that's President Karzai's half-brother, who was assassinated just days after Mayor Hamidi was assassinated. in Kandahar. In fact, I can I remember the day Wally Karzai was killed very clearly, because we were expecting the city to explode. We were expecting, as my one fixer said, for blood to be running in the gutters. And as gruesome as it may sound, Wally Karzai was assassinated by one of his own bodyguards in a what it amounts to, or what was eventually found out to be, sort of a personal dispute. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say, thank God it was a personal dispute. Because had it been the Taliban, I mean, the Taliban claimed responsibility anyway, but had it really truly been the Taliban, then there would have been blood in the streets. And I mean, I can remember driving down the main road in Kandahar, this one main boulevard, and the body of the assassin was strung on piano wire, or concertina wire, over the top, second story top of the building. That's just to give you an idea as to how brutal the place can be and how swift and brutal the justice was there. But Ahmad Wali Karzai was a feared man. He had his fingers in every pie. He was, if you've read the New York Times, if you read a number of our accounts as well, he was supposedly into drug dealing, or at least facilitating the drug trafficking. He was supposedly linked and negotiating and talking with the Taliban. My favorite memory of him, though, was our first interview, when he sat an AK-74 on the coffee table in between us before our interview began. It had just been given to him as a gift, and he was very excited, and he just wanted to show me his new gun. And needless to say, most of my questions were softballs during that interview. But when, you know, we were talking about what Kandahar needed, he was talking about our need to have massive public works projects to put a lot of people to work there. And it was interesting because he underscored that unemployment was the real enemy there. But what did the Canadian public hear? What did you folks hear back here? What I consider to be a lot of empty, tub-thumping rhetoric about terrorists. Now, that's not to diminish the horrors of what the Taliban were doing to their own people and to ours, because I can say with a great deal of conviction, I've been on the other end of Taliban ambushes and bullets. But that they were allowed to do it and given safe haven by those around them, and I don't mean Pakistan, I'm talking the people in the villages around them, should have been screaming at us, and it wasn't. Many of those who were shooting at us, contrary to what you may perceive, they were not highly trained, Homeland style, if you watch the TV show Homeland, Homeland style terrorists, okay? They were simple farmers, they were ordinary people who were being paid $10 to $25 a day to plant bombs because they needed the cash. Those are the people who were shooting at us. What was our solution? What was the solution of the international community? Well, you may have heard about some of the massive public works programs that we undertook in Kandahar. The rebuilding of the Dala Dam, as an example. But I'll bet you didn't realize that many of those massive international programs left very little dollars or very little employment in Kandahar or in Afghanistan itself, because they were carried out by international companies who often brought in their own people. And a lot of the cash was just funneled through Afghanistan and back into the coffers of some of the major corporations in this country, in the United States, in the UK, etc. It was make work projects for some of our multinational companies. And I remember Wally Karzai saying that even if we paid Afghans to move one rock pile from one side of the road to the other and then back again, it would be better than having them build bombs. We had trouble listening, ladies and gentlemen. And we were often so sure of ourselves, we were often so sure of our own methods and our own moral superiority that the wishes of the people we were trying to serve were drowned out by the grind of a publicity machine that was trying to assure everyone back here that we were doing good deeds. Little known fact, the Canadian military conducted public opinion surveys on the streets of Kandahar throughout the war. It started in 2007 and ran right up until the day we pulled the last of the troops out in the summer of 2011. I have a whole filing cabinet full of these public opinion surveys. And for anyone who reads polls for a living as I do, the level of detail just leaves you absolutely gobsmacked. They asked ordinary Afghans everything. They asked about the number of farm animals needed for a healthy business. They asked about educating women. They asked about whether military convoys drove too fast through their neighborhoods. But the most relevant, the most startling aspect was the consistency of the message that we were getting back. In fact, I'm almost certain the Afghans, if they participated in more than one of these surveys, would have looked at us and wanted to slap some of the pollsters. Because over and over again, over 4 years, the Afghans listed their number one concern as jobs and the economy. Their number two concern, in Kandahar in particular, was the supply of stable electricity. The third concern was security. So, when it came time to design the programs that we were going to deliver for the Afghans, our benchmarks and priorities, what did we give them? Does anybody remember? Health, in terms of polio immunization, education by the way of rebuilding schools, and irrigation through the reconstruction of the Dala Dam. Now, those priorities were on the list of people in Kandahar, but they were way down in terms of what the Afghans really needed and wanted to get themselves back on their feet. They were a society in survival mode. And strangely enough, those are the policies. Those policies that we gave to the that we imposed upon the Afghans, they're the things that we hold dear in Canada. Healthcare, education, agriculture, yeah, but that was maybe there was a bit of a recognition of, you know, how bad things were there. And I'm just amazed that it wasn't part of what they wanted, what they asked for. And I thought to myself, as I'm reading some of these polls, how utterly, the word I wanted to use was ignorant, but just like ungracious. Because when someone, you ask somebody, what do you need? What can I do for you? And then they tell you, and then you give them something completely opposite. Or like something that they necessarily can't use right now. Even though Kandahar appears remote and mysterious to most people, there are commonalities and reference points for us. They have a chamber of commerce in Kandahar City. We're like-minded business people complain about services. They complain about they're paying too much for those government services, and when the government listens to them. Here, highway construction and the digging of tunnels for light rail are an annoyance. Over there, it's how quickly do the holes get filled from roadside bombs. In Kandahar, the business group is called the Industrial Association. And I recall sitting in the living room of the association's head, and we were talking about, essentially, the need for electricity. And I can remember him leaning into me, the association director. And he was talking about how there were a number of businesses in Kandahar that were closed because they had no stable power supply. They had no stable electricity. And he leaned into me and said, if we had a stable supply of electricity, I could put 6,500 people to work tomorrow just from the businesses that are closed today. He says, those are 6,500 people that wouldn't be shooting at you. We never began to address the electricity issue. In fact, it wasn't until the Americans came that that issue started to be resolved by the arrival of diesel electric generators. But the debate became, after the diesel electric generators arrived, who's going to pay for the fuel long term? At that point, I just about lost my mind. It's like I said, are you kidding me? The amount of fuel that was being burned by the helicopters and jets that were taking off from Kandahar Airfield 24/7 could have powered those generators, those electrical generators that would have brought light, water, and stability to vast parts of that city. All of that was being burned in one afternoon at Kandahar Airfield when it could have been in those generators. They eventually solved it, but I said to myself, like, really? You would rather continue to prosecute a war rather than, you know, try and end this. At least it would have been a small step towards ending it. There were that's just one of the things that was utterly astonishing. And it had more of a ring of excuse than it did of rationality for me. One of the other minor and often subtle tragedies of this war was the sense of moral superiority that we brought to dealing with Afghans, whether it was our frequent lectures about corruption or our insistence on gender equality. It was delivered with an evangelical zeal. Now, one understands that when a country such as ours is going to be handing over hard-earned tax dollars to another nation, there is an expectation that the money is going to be well spent. Sort of like lending your neighbor $1,000 and then being really upset if he blew it all on cocaine. The hypocrisy from some of our diatribes, though, would simply leave you speechless. And it was always a wedge issue that I happily exploited, because if it was only a matter of trying to help keep our people in perspective about these things. I wrote a piece in 2006 about Canadian efforts to train an honest and ethical Afghan civil service in Kabul, but I couldn't resist tweaking the lead by writing, the country that has just mopped up the Liberal sponsorship scandal is about to tell Afghans how to run a squeaky clean administration. It's even funnier now in light of what's happened up in the Senate. But the notion is that there is a whiff of hypocrisy in our pronouncements, okay, was never lost on the Afghans whom I dealt with. Despite having a ruined country, they could see the world around them and they could see what was going on. And there was never more hollow an argument in the minds of many Afghans, okay, than in our insistence on women's rights. Now, I really have to underscore here, okay, that without reservation, I believe fully in the unencumbered participation of women in all levels of society, and it's absolutely essential for that society to thrive and survive. But the majority of men in Afghanistan do not subscribe to that notion, especially in the rural areas, and that goes without saying. But we were clearly dreaming in Technicolor that it's such a violent and backward place that allows legalized rape within a Shia marriage and the selling of child brides, and that these matters were going to disappear overnight. We were clearly dreaming in Technicolor. The kind of social progress that we enjoy, the kind of enlightenment that we had, has taken decades. It has taken hundreds of years to evolve, and yet we were expecting the Afghans to do it like that. The burqa, in our eyes, is a symbol of repression, and in my estimation it is, because it makes women ghosts on the streets in Kandahar. But I had a most interesting debate with an articulate young Afghan who argued that it's a symbol of modesty, he tried to tell me. Not unlike the long skirts and cloaks our society insisted women wear until only just a few decades ago. This young man chided me and said that for a society that claimed to respect women, our culture objectified them and allowed them to parade around half naked. That we tied many of our development programs to social progress, very much like cable companies bundle TV channels that you don't want, was not an approach that served us very well in Afghanistan. And as I said, almost from the moment I began this evening, history is what we make of it. And I would suggest to you that if we fail to learn those lessons, if we fail to examine what has happened and our conduct and challenge our assumptions, then we are bound to repeat these mistakes. For all the attention that was paid on ramp ceremonies in Afghanistan, we seem to have forgotten that the war was very real and very deadly. If those 160 lives, 158 soldiers, a diplomat, and a journalist are going to be worth it, then we have to commit ourselves to understanding what went wrong. Otherwise, the struggle is lost. And as I also said at the beginning of this evening, my colleagues in the media have an important role to play in fostering that thought and debate. Unfortunately, our coverage lately has looked more like a bad reality TV show than it has about the sort of challenging and thought-provoking journalism that we expect, or we have come to expect. Where it comes to war, the kind of conflict that we have witnessed in Afghanistan, my estimation, is the kind of conflict that our generation is going to have to fight. And we need to do a better job. Thanks very much for listening, and I'm happy to take any of your questions.
You've been listening to a recording of Murray Brewster's talk, After the Savage War, reporting on battles in Afghanistan and at home. It was part of the 2013 Ottawa Historical Association Lecture Series. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.